You're listening to the Festival Daily Buzz with Bitch Talk podcast on KCPW, kcpw.org, bff.fm, and kfog.com. It's day 7 with the 2019 Sundance Film Festival. I'm John Wildman, and we are on location at Slamdance headquarters on historic Main Street, interviewing some of this year's most important and exciting voices in independent film. Joining me this morning are my co-hosts from Bitch Talk, Aaron Lim and Angela Tabora. On today's episode, we're going to start off with a session with Firelight Docs, and with that, we have the film Always in Season with Jackie Olive, she's the director of that film, and Miles Davis, Birth of the Cool with Stanley Nelson, as well as Firelight's Loida Limbaugh, she's the vice president there. And then we have The Brink, Allison Clayman, the director of that film will be here, and Memory, The Origins of Alien with Alexander Philippe. And then we're going to finish up with a slam dance movie, that's Happy Face. We have Alexander Franchi, he's the director, co-writer, along with his co-writer, Joel Abojali. And we have the cast members, David Roche, Cindy Nicholson, E.R. Ruiz, and Don Shaw. You're listening to the Festival Daily Buzz with Bitch Talk Podcast. My name is John Wildman, here with my Bitch Talk co-hosts Aaron Lim and Angela Tabora. We have a documentary segment coming here with a couple great films. The films are Always in Season. We have Jackie Olive, the director of that film, and Miles Davis, Birth of the Cool, and we have Stanley Nelson, the director of that film. And with them, we have from Firelight, Loida Limbaugh. Welcome.
Thank you so much. Great to be here.
Okay, so let's start with our films. And Jackie, tell our listeners what Always in Season is about.
Yeah, well, I spent 10 years filming in communities where lynchings happened with relatives of the perpetrators and the victims who are seeking justice and reconciliation. And had been filming for 5 years when I came across the story of a 17-year-old named Lennon Lacey, who was found hanging from a swing set in 2014 in Bladenboro, North Carolina. And I immediately saw the connections between what I'd been seeing in communities where people were still dealing with the fallout of those historic lynchings. You could see it show up in Bladenboro in the way that the police very quickly dismissed the case and called his death a suicide within 3 days. There were all of these similarities about the way that black people are dehumanized and the way that we haven't gotten justice historically showing up right then in 2014.
And Stanley, tell us about Miles Davis, Birth of the Cool.
So Miles Davis, Birth of the Cool, in quick terms, is a biography of Miles Davis. It was made in complete cooperation with Miles' family and with Sony Music. So there's music that's never been heard before and pictures and footage that have never been seen before. And it's a look at Miles's career. We use Miles's voice from his autobiography. We have an actor kind of playing Miles from his own words in Miles's autobiography. So in some ways, it's Miles's story told through Miles's own words.
And Stanley, I've had the opportunity to interview you for other films that you've done, the pleasure of doing so, and you have a wonderful talent for letting us know some details that we didn't know about people and about subjects that we thought we had a bead on. Mm-hmm. Talk about that. Talk about your process to get us into an aspect of Miles Davis that that aren't commonly there, but known.
Yeah, I mean, I think that Miles Davis's story is a especially tricky one for a bunch of reasons. But one, because there's some people who know a lot about Miles, mm-hmm. you know, who think they know everything, and there's some people who don't know anything. And so we try to make a film that would appeal to everybody, and everybody could learn something from Miles' story. But I think, Miles grew up. Miles' father was a dentist in East St. Louis, and Miles grew up in a very wealthy situation. As someone says in the beginning of the film, his father was the second richest black man in Illinois when Miles grew up. Miles grew up living in the city, but they had a farm that they would visit with, and Miles had horses to ride and those kind of things, and that's who Miles was. And so there's that kind of juxtaposed with the fact that he's growing up in the South during segregation. And so there's all of that, and told in Miles' own words. We use a bunch of people who played with Miles, friends of Miles. Miles's first wife, Frances, is in the film, and she's just kind of an incredible character. All of this is part of the film.
Lloyd, I want to get you in on this. I want you to talk about Firelight, introduce people to what that may not be familiar with Firelight, and what you do.
Sure. So Firelight was founded about almost 20 years ago, and really began as a nonprofit production company to produce Stan Lee's work. And we did that for many years, produced several of Stan Lee's films. And then along the way, emerging filmmakers of color started to sort of show up on Stan Lee's doorstep, literally and figuratively, asking for advice and, you know, just counsel and, can you watch my cut? Do you have feedback? How do I do this? How do I do that? And Stan Lee began to do some mentorship work, you know, initially very informally, then went on to do some executive producing for projects. So one of the kind of projects that was a catalyst for the lab was Beyond Beats and Rhymes by Byron Hurt, which Stan Lee was an executive producer on. And Stan Lee really worked very closely with Byron through the process of making that film and helping him launch it. And from there, you know, we kind of got the idea that, you know, there perhaps was an opportunity to do more of this work if we built a little bit of infrastructure around it. And that's really how the idea for creating a lab that would support emerging filmmakers of color working on their first features or their second features was born.
And what is it? Oh, sorry. Go ahead.
No, I should just add that we have two feature films that we worked with at Sundance, and one feature film that we are still working with at Slamdance.
Mm-hmm. I was going to just ask, and each of you can answer, but what does it mean to be at Sundance?
Yeah, it's great. My film, Always in Season, premiered Saturday, and it's been a really beautiful thing after working on the project for a decade to get it out there, and also to be able to bring the people that I've been filming with here at really the biggest festival in the country and right. One of the best festivals in the world, for them to get the response that they've gotten to the film, which has been really overwhelmingly positive, has been a really beautiful gift. And I'll say that I'm one of those filmmakers who showed up on Stan Lee's door.
You've got a personal story.
Yeah, I have a personal story. I finished grad school in Florida and was looking at what filmmaker I wanted to work with, who was the best in the industry. So I called up Stan Lee.
No pressure.
I said, I'd love to intern with you. And he said, yeah, come on out, very generously. And then I got out and he's like, I didn't know you were coming. I didn't think you were going to come. But I was serious because I wanted to learn the industry, and it's been a really valuable lessons and lots of insights into the process of filmmaking.
Well, I would love for you to also talk about that process of making Always in Season, because, you know, certainly as Stan Lee, I'm sure, told you, the journey to complete a film can sometimes be quick, sometimes it takes a while. I remember working with the great Heather Ray on her documentary, doing the PR for her documentary Trudell, and it took her 13 years. She had two kids in between the time she started to finishing it, and you know, and that's what had to happen with that film. So talk about, you know, the process, a 10-year process, and how you were able to keep going with it.
Yeah.
Because when you have that duration, there are moments where you're going, I'm just going to tuck this away, put it in a drawer.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, interestingly, I never thought about that until probably the last 6 months of making this film. So from about 9 years to 6 months, I was very, very determined. And I got to a point where it got to be, I wasn't seeing the doors opening that I needed to see open. And I decided to just leave it, not to give it up, but to just let it sit and see what comes. And then that's when I got ITVS funding, which was the money. ITVS is the last funding in, and it's the funding that really allowed me to go and move through production and into post-production. But documentaries, they take a while. It takes being really embedded into a community, not just showing up. I used to shoot news, sports, and weather. Uh-huh. I used to be a reporter as well. And so it's not just showing up in the way that news does, but really living in the community and understanding the stories. And then one of the storylines that I film around historic lynchings is a reenactment that happens in Monroe, Georgia. Mm-hmm. And that happens annually, so it's once a year. So, and I filmed over 3 years, so I had to wait a year to go back and get the things that I needed to make the footage consistent.
Yeah, that's what I wanted to talk to you about. First of all, thank you for sharing this story. I can't imagine living with it for 10 years, something so heavy.
It's my pleasure.
I think it's something, you said something like 20 of these lynchings have happened in a similar fashion in just the past few years. Mm-hmm. But it was really interesting how divisive these reenactments are within the community, and some people are really against them, and for some people they're so moving, like people brought to tears every year. So how was it for you filming those reenactments, and what was your take on the community and how it helps?
Sure.
Move forward.
Yeah, absolutely. Those are two things. I'll speak to the first. The reenactment, when I first got there the first year, there's a lot going on, of course, because they're in real time and they're on the spot where the violence happened. And so people are there, the reenactors, who are a diverse group of people who come together to reenact a quadruple lynching of two couples, the Malcolms and the Dorseys, in Monroe, Georgia, in 1946. And so there's an audience that comes to watch them reenact. And that audience is typically very overwhelmingly African American, but other people come. Some people come from other countries, but it's mostly from people who live in the area and in the state. And the reenactors do that because they want to make sure that the victims are never forgotten. Mm-hmm. They believe some of the perpetrators may still be living. Mm-hmm. That happened in 1946. My mother was alive in 1946. That was just a generation ago. Mm-hmm. And so people want to wall themselves off from this history. One, it wasn't that long ago in certain cases. And two, even when it was, there were people whose lives were affected, people whose land was stolen, people whose beloved relatives were murdered, and very publicly, often with half the town watching. Mm-hmm. And so that still has lingering effects.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. It's a really powerful scene with grandmother, I think she was, just kind of breaking down, and her grandkids watching her.
Sure.
It's important to understand that history, and we can't erase it.
Yeah, and I'll just say one other thing about the other part of your question, is that these cases that the NAACP attorney who pulled together the evidence for the Lynn and Lacey case, Heather Radelaide, that she mentions in the film, she mentions 20 other hangings of Black people hung publicly from trees often. Mm-hmm. In recent years prior to Lennon's death in 2014, and recent years after. Mm-hmm. Those numbers are low. That's her personal research. But as I've looked, there have been dozens of cases. The thing is that because we don't know what happened, which is true in Lennon's case, his death was improperly investigated. So a lot of that evidence is lost. So as a journalist, I can't call that a lynching because I don't know. I don't know what happened, whether it was a suicide or a lynching, in the same way that the community is left with rumors, speculation, and stories.
Well, I can only hope that with what happens with this film is the same that happened with the podcast Serial or Making a Murderer, that you open somebody's eyes to it and they're like, no, we're going to come and we're going to fight pro bono work, whatever they can do to at least have it researched and looked into, because it's like they didn't do anything. They're just like, oh, it was a suicide.
Yeah.
Moving on.
That's a gift.
I'm hoping that's an outcome of
that would be a gift to the family. What's equally as important is we start to look at these systems of policing, mm-hmm. how law enforcement shows up in these communities, mm-hmm. when it's Black people, brown people, people of color, mm-hmm. In the judicial system, mass incarceration, all these issues of systemic racism that when you solve one case, it's still a problem. And so the idea is that we start to discuss these issues and tackle them.
Great, thank you.
We don't have a lot of time left, but I did want to bring this back to Loida and talk about the business of documentary filmmaking. We have two very different documentaries, mm-hmm. here, and the prospects for what they do following their debuts here at Sundance, whether it be extensive film festival tours, whether it was going to PBS, whether we can, there are any number of things that can happen. And I would love for you and then Stanley as well to talk about that and talk about what is on the horizon, for the films that you're doing at Firelight and that you're pushing at Firelight.
Sure. So I would say, there's something that actually Stanley, I'm going to quote Stanley really quickly. He says often is that part of our goal with starting the documentary lab was to support filmmakers of color so that they could really pay their rent and buy their groceries, through their work, that they could be paid for their work, make a living. It's a career, not a very sustainable one, but we want it to become more so, so that filmmakers of color can stay in the space and tell these stories from different points of view and different lived experiences. So, you know, for us, that's really the starting point. The work that we do, I think across the board, not just our production work, but very shortly after we were founded, we began to do what used to be called outreach and is now called engagement, because the ethos of Firelight is that we deeply believe that it is really important for communities of color to tell their own stories and to have spaces to engage with their own stories. We need to be revisiting history from different perspectives. We've had one gaze, it's been the white gaze, to all of our detriment, not just communities of color, but the nation as a whole. And in order to sort of figure out how to move forward, especially in these times that we're living in, we desperately need, you know, new stories and new vantage points and new gazes. And so that's sort of what we are all about. And in order to do that, we do have to engage with the business, right? And so that means any number of things. Both of these films are PBS films. They were both supported by the public television system. Miles will be on American Masters.
Independent Lens.
And Always in Season will be in Independent Lens. I was just making sure that we could say that. Yes. and as Jackie said, it was supported by ITVS, which I do have to say, you know, if we talk about a documentary golden age in this country right now, really is in great part due to the work of public media. They've been championing, you know, Independent Lens, POV, and others have been really for many years the only spaces for independent, truly independent documentaries and filmmakers, and championing that. And so, you know, now we, the Netflixes of the world, have this wonderful landscape to, you know, be a part of. But, you know, I just want to sort of do that quick nod, because I think it's well deserved.
Absolutely.
Yes, but it does mean that we are, you know, doing engagement campaigns, bringing them out to communities, film festival, you know, circuit, every which way that we can get these films out there, both so that the people that they're about can see them, but also so that our filmmakers can keep making their work.
Well, these two films should be out there, and again, the films are Always in Season. We've had Jackie Olive, the director of that film, with us, and Miles Davis, Birth of the Cool. We've had the wonderful Stanley Nelson, the director of that film, with us, and also joined by Loida Limbaugh, from the vice president of Firelight. We are back on the Festival Daily Buzz with Bitch Talk Podcast. My name is John Wildman, here with the Bitch Talk co-hosts Aaron Lim and Angela Tabora. Our segment here is about The Brink. It's a documentary screening at Sundance. We have our director, Allison Clayman. Allison, welcome to the show.
Hi, it's so nice to be here. Thanks,
okay,
guys.
Okay, Allison, tell us about
Explain yourself,
The Brink.
Allison.
Explain yourself.
So when I was here at Sundance last year, I had already started filming The Brink. I followed Steve Bannon around from right after he left the White House through to the midterms. So it was about October 2017 to November 2018. And, you know, the whole project was basically to see what he was focusing on, not to, you know, I think interviewing someone, you know, he's an important guy, and figuring out what he's about in a combative interview style is really limited, because he kind of thrives on that. He also isn't honest, and he'll, you know, duck and weave and change the subject. But, you know, he is someone who, you know, is very, very active. So to see what he's working on, who he's meeting with, you know, where he's going, you know, the actions, you know, you can't spin that. It is what it is. And so I was able to get access and kind of insert myself. And so the whole film is cinema verite, you know, no talking heads, no interviews. And it ends up following, you know, his quest to build this far right global movement.
I guess my first question is, how did he let you do this? We're all huge fans of Ai Weiwei, Never Sorry. Just such a great film.
Thank you so much.
Why did he let you do this?
Well, the like first answer to that is, like, I mean, I don't know. Like, I guess you'd have to ask him. I think, you know, fundamentally on many questions about him, for as intimate of a portrait, you know, I'll put air quotes, but like intimate of a portrait as this is, you know, I don't know what's in his heart, and I don't know why he does what he does. You know, I just know what he does, and he agreed to it. You know, I think in part, there's ego, you know, being approached mm-hmm. and being told, you know, there's going to be an opportunity to have a, you know, prestigious, culturally relevant documentary made about you. And he also someone who, part of his background, he's had many lives in the Navy and Goldman Sachs, but also in the entertainment industry. And I think right. that being interested in culture, you know, it was something that it appealed to something that was already there for him.
I mean, he is a, you could say, a failed producer, film producer. And, you know, and once you've, you know, you've had a taste of that, it's hard to get it out of you, that desire to, you know, for someone to give you that kind of feedback. I was wrong. You know, it's funny that The Brink and Where's My Roy Cohn and at the same festival.
Yes, I was just on a panel with Matt last night for The Atlantic, the director of Where's My Roy Cohn.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And it's fascinating because both films are kind of almost like warnings to us all about two guys. You know, I really wanted to have you weigh in as a filmmaker. Yes, a cinema verite approach, but it's a cinema verite approach with your eyeballs on it.
100%. And I think that's really important. What you're seeing is what I think is the truest distillation of him as I witnessed and I experienced over the last year. Right. Mm-hmm. And, you know, this is I think it's a very fair portrayal. That, again, is what he was promised too. It's like not cheap shots, but, mm-hmm. you know, it is what it is. And it's, you know, hundreds of hours and a year's worth of time curated down into 90 minutes. And I think that's very different than just giving someone the space to, you know, say what they want to say. I think it's like a study of how they say things, how they operate. And, you know, for me, my biggest takeaway is, you know, this was the central tension of this entire thing, both of making the film, but also the experience of shooting it, is thinking about how, you know, is this guy an evil genius mastermind, pulling the strings? That was kind of his reputation when I first met him. You know, it's like, this is the guy that gave us Donald Trump. And sort of I wasn't sure that it was like that, because as soon as you get up close, you see the organization is kind of a little bit slapdash, disorganized. Like you're in there, you're like, I don't think this is like a mastermind situation. But then truthfully, when I started, I was like, great, this is one of my inspirations was Veep. You know, I was like it was Veep. But on the flip side, I don't think, certainly the conclusion is not to then. Only, you know, you can laugh with him or at him, but it's not to dismiss his importance. And so it's like always carrying this tension and like this balance of like, how do you not, you know, prop him up and give him more credit than he deserves, but also how do you make clear that there is a warning here and there's something very, very dangerous. And I think that like the answer is kind of in this tension, and like the film like lives in this tension. So, you know, Roy Cohn has been, you know, dead for a few decades. So mm-hmm. also the, you know, people can kind of weigh in on what they think the legacy is. And I think Bannon, you know, Roy Cohn really was this behind the scenes, you know, power broker. And Bannon is something different. And mm-hmm. one of the things he is a master messenger, right? And that is something that you see a lot in the film too. So then that again becomes the question, is his power itself like part of his message? Like, is he trying to sell the world on his power?
Right. Mm-hmm. Well, yeah, and I'd put it more in the Lee Atwater category.
Yeah.
You know, as far as that, how they affect the political spectrum. And I also think with a guy like Bannon, as opposed to Roy Cohn, that they're much more a reflection of us. Mm. You know, and our current state of what we're respond to, what we're, you know, so to speak, attracted to. I hate to say that with Steve Bannon, but, you know.
No, and it's true. I mean, like the whole, you know, another important thing of this film was not for it to just be like, you know, narrow tunnel vision all about Steve Bannon. It was right. like, how is Steve Bannon like an entree to understanding something about us right now and the world right now.
Globally.
Yeah, and where things are headed. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, to me, it was the experience of making it, again, because it's verite as opposed to looking back on things that have happened. I mean, you don't always know what the significance of the events you're filming are. But, you know, from going around in the U.S. and, you know, you're seeing there's lines of people waiting to take photos with him, which, again, from my side of the political mm-hmm. spectrum, mm-hmm. was like shocking in itself. Mm-hmm. You know, I kept joking there could be a subtitle for the movie. It's like white women love Steve Bannon, but like people just love, like,
a lot. I thought that's the hashtag. Yeah. Just
there are a lot of people who like really are enamored of him in the U.S. and then internationally. You know, I really fought hard to get access to. You know, I tried to like be in the room when things were happening and it was true meetings and not just for my benefit or for the camera. And, you know, when you sit there and he's convening, you know, members of far right parties from various countries and they're having a dinner in a 5-star hotel over wine talking about, you know, dismantling the EU and, you know, how they see a potential path to it through the EU elections in 2019. I mean, at the end of that night, I was just like, what did I just witness? Like, did I, you know, I remember I called my husband. I was like, either I just was like at the WANSEE conference or I just like, you know, watched a bunch of people have dinner. Like, I'm not really sure. So, you know, I think that's, again, like the power of Verdi. And it did feel like documenting history, but without being enamored of the access itself or like thinking that everything I saw had to be important because I was filming it. Like, I felt very skeptical about everything I saw.
Yeah, that was going to be my question for you is how were you treated within this community, especially under the guise of fake news, fake media? You're walking around a woman with a camera. Yep. They weren't sure of your political beliefs, but how were you treated by this community? And did you ever, were you ever so angry or, you know, how were you able to separate yourself?
Totally. I'm like feeling it all as you're like talking about it. I mean, I was not undercover. 100%. It was, you know, certainly to Bannon and his core team who like knew me. I mean, he would joke to me, oh, my Brown University lefty commie, you know, flaming, you know, whatever. Like he was, you know, kind of, but in a nice way.
Yeah.
Most of the time.
Okay. Okay.
I mean, I was like, yeah, call me a lefty. Great. Like, and it also made me feel good that, you know, he knew where I was coming from, you know, expected that I was there to be critical. But because it was fly on the wall, like my job was not to like speak up every time I thought a falsehood was said or some, you know, or even I watched people and I wished, you know, a journalist pushed back more or whatever it is. I mean, it really was a lot of like biting your tongue over time because he and I did have conversations. You know, we started to, there are a few things where I let us argue because I also wanted to see if I could push him because I watched so many different people come and push him because he did do a lot of interviews over the course of the last year. He became very much someone who people were willing to have on shows, do hour-long, you know, interviews with him. And I, you know, so I did kind of test the waters a little bit, but for the most part, I felt like my job was not to put so much of myself out there and really just observe. And to be honest, that was hard. And, you know, I tried to have some time on and time off, but his team was very nice to me. Like they didn't see me as the enemy, but you know, they could control when I could film and when I couldn't film. That was kind of, you know, the way it worked. Mm-hmm.
And we don't have a lot of time left, but I also would love to have you talk about the editing process for a film like this, because of your approach that takes on a different air when you're in the editing bay.
Totally. And I think because we finished it very, very fast, which was another big challenge. But I think I had such clarity, if I can say so myself, but I had such clarity of purpose by the time we got to the end of the year, because working on this was constantly asking myself, like, what am I doing here? And what is the value of this? And this better be worth it. Certainly it was like a painful experience to go around the world by myself doing this. I was like, you know, it has to be worth it. So I feel like once we got to the edit and I knew we were no matter what going to finish really fast, you know, I had to already have a sense of what we're doing. And because it's a year and I knew we were going to end at the midterms, there ended up being kind of like, you know, and it's verite, you kind of know what the arc is going to be. And part of how we made things happen fast was throwing more bodies at it. So I worked with two editors. And then once I stopped filming, kind of was a co-editor as well. And they agreed to work in Premiere so that, because I was like, I can't work in Avid, I just don't know it. So they were willing to work in Premiere so we could all work together. And every day we were all like working on different parts of the movie or trading things back and forth. And I feel really lucky that, you know, we turned around a lot of cuts in a short amount of time, but it always looked like the movie I had imagined in my head. Mm-hmm. And I really do think it's because I just spent so much time thinking about what am I doing here? I really had such a clear idea of what I had and what it should be by the time, you know, the midterms ended and I took the mic back from him at like 2 a.m.
Okay. And scene.
Drop the mic.
Well, the film is The Brink. We've been talking to Allison Clayman, the director of the film. And Allison, thank you for being here.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
You're listening to the Festival Daily Buzz with the Bitch Talk podcast on KCPW. This episode is supported in part by Black Rain, Studio Movie Grill, and Slopestyle Realty.
My name is John Wildman, here with my Bitch Talk co-hosts, Aaron Lim and Angela Deborah. This segment, we're going to be discussing Memory, the origins of Alien. We have the director of that film, Alexander Philippe, here. Alexander, nice to have you back.
Thank you.
And of course, I say have you back because you were here with 7852 just a couple of years ago. Mm-hmm. The film based on the Psycho shower scene, which I truly loved, and this one, man, two for two. I love this film. so obviously, in the title, it gives us an idea of what the film is. But man, talk about just scratching the surface. So tell our listeners a little bit more about what the film is.
Sure. I mean, Memory is obviously an origin story about Alien, but it's also very much a mythological take on the movie Alien. It looks at all of the really, quite frankly, the deepest roots, you know, from Greek and Egyptian mythologies to underground comics, parasitic wasps. I mean, you name it. There's a lot of different influences, but really, it's a film that focuses on the extraordinary symbiosis between Dan O'Bannon, H.R. Giger, and Ridley Scott that gave us Alien. It is a film about the resonance of myth, and it's also very much a film about the collective unconscious.
Well, there was so much that was just unexpected about this movie. I mean, which was just wonderful, and including the framing device of the Furies and all yep. of that. And I would love for you to talk about that, about your approach to this subject, because you could have taken a lot of approaches.
Yeah. So yeah, well, you know, I realized very early in the process that, you know, if you to do a deep dive into the chestburster scene, which was the original intent, it's a very different beast than tackling the Psycho shower scene. To me, what's really interesting is this idea that Alien was not a film that was supposed to be a success in 1979, when audiences were quite frankly ready for, you know, the cute, cuddly, friendly Alien. Right. And so what exactly happened? And I think, you know, without giving away much of Memory, but there's an idea to me that are collectively, there are certain ideas and images that resonate with us. And in fact, concepts that we need to process as a collective. And sometimes, even though it's happening against the grain, there are certain movies that burst onto the screen just the way that Alien did, and there was something that we needed to process. Part of the argument of Alien, of Memory, is that there was an unconscious patriarchal guilt, which we're finally now 40 years later starting to actually have conversations about it. But in 1979, obviously, this was not something that we were talking about. But I do believe that that's what this movie rattled audiences to their core, especially men. So there's a lot of, you know, it's a very different film than 1752, and I think it dives, you know, much deeper into this idea of you know, popular film, you know, popular cinema, and the connection of popular cinema with our collective unconscious.
Talk a little bit about Dan O'Bannon.
Ah, well.
But, you know, because this is a guy that so many of us, you know, he's almost like he takes on mythological proportions, you know, in some extent. And, you know, and yet, again, and there's so much that we don't know. And you got incredible access.
Yeah, that was very serendipitous. In fact, Frank Pavich, the director of Jodorowsky's Dune, the wonderful documentary, I'm a huge fan of it, put me in touch with Diane O'Bannon and, you know, went to see her in her house in San Diego. And she was very hesitant because, you know, she's been very, very protective of his archives. There's a lot of stuff that has never, ever been shown before. And... And, you know, just showing up there, you know, all these boxes were opened, and you know, there's this the script, the original script for Memory, of which there are two versions. There's version A and version B, and, you know, they're both about 30 pages. All these, you know, drawings, you know, storyboards, early, early storyboards where the derelict was a pyramid at the time. All that stuff. And, you know, eventually, you know, she realized that this was the time to do this, and I told her, I said, you know, it's clear to me that if you're going to, you know, give us access to those archives, that this film very much has to be about Dan. And I think Dan is the forgotten hero of Alien. I mean, obviously Ridley Scott certainly has been celebrated. I mean, Giger has been celebrated, although I don't think he's quite gotten his due. But Dan has been the forgotten hero. And so I'm very glad that this film, I think, puts a spotlight on him. Just the way that 1752 put a spotlight on Marley Renfro, the right. buddy double from the shower scene, that, you know, who was also kind of forgotten in film history. So,
right. And the other thing I'd love for you to talk about is Brandywine, and in the idea that you know, this incredible franchise of films and creativity, it seems, you know, in the film, it seems as though they never really completely understood what they had.
Right. Well, you know, I think that, again, and this is part of, you know, going back to the idea of the Furies and going back to the idea of the unconscious. If you think about what Alien, what the chestburster represents, what the xenomorph is about, you know, what really happens on the screen, the subversion that happens in 1979, I don't think any of those people, quite frankly, had any conscious thought about, oh yeah, this is what we're doing. These are the ideas that we're actually putting out onto, you know, putting on the screen. But I think that that's how it works sometimes. You know, you're coming up with an idea. In fact, Dan O'Bannon was tapping into, well, he was stepping into myth, he was stepping into Lovecraft, he was stepping into comic books, he was stepping into a number of sci-fi movies that existed in the B realm. I mean, the story of Alien, if you look at Planet of the Vampires, if you look at It, the Terror from Beyond Space, if you look at Queen of Blood, I mean, that's basically Alien. So those ideas, those, you know, that particular story, in a way, existed in the B realm. There was something, it just needed that extra push. It needed that encounter with that, you know, with Giger. It needed Ridley Scott to be at the helm to execute those scenes in this particular way to make it work in as a blockbuster film.
Right.
You
right.
know. Right. So that's but again, yeah, I think a lot of what was going on and what they did, I mean, you know, Ridley Scott will be the first one to say, oh, you know, Alien is a haunted house movie in space.
Yeah.
Well, sure, it is, but it's a lot more than that.
Yeah. Right, right, right.
And for the bitches over here, because I think this is something that's out of our realm in terms of this kind of genre. Can
you talk
to audiences about why you pick these moments and why you focus on pop culture moments?
You know, it's really interesting to me that this is something that I've been doing now for 12 years. Mm-hmm. And it's almost like these moments pick me, if it makes any sense.
Yes.
I mean, it took me several years to realize after, you know, a number of films that, well, you know, there's a pattern here. I'm very interested in, well, obviously I'm a huge film buff and a film geek, but I'm particularly interested in those moments in cinema that resonate with audiences, that in essence transcend cinema and that get into culture in a way that we can all relate to, that sort of bring us together. And there's so few of them. I mean, if you think about moments like the chestburster, moments like the shower scene, moments like you know, the final scene of the Blair Witch Project, which is
still an
unbelievable moment, you know? Those are very, very rare. And so I'm really interested in that, you know, and so, you know, at Exhibited Pictures, now we've been, you know, we've been making those films for a while. The next one, by the way, is on The Exorcist.
Oh, wow. Of course it is.
Yes. So that's, you know, that's, and it's a very, very different approach also. On
Thanks for
I was about to ask, you know, whether or not you were building toward the most awesome box set ever.
Yes. Oh, yes.
That makes sense.
Criterion, are you listening?
Well, again, we've been talking about the film Memory, the Origins of Alien documentary that's screening at Sundance, and we've been talking to the director, Alexander Philippe. It's been great to have you back.
It's a pleasure. Thank you so much.
And we are back on the Festival Daily Buzz with Bitch Talk Podcast. My name is John Wildman, here with my Bitch Talk co-hosts Aaron Lim and Angela Tabora. I've been looking forward to talking about this film. The title of the film is Happy Face. It screens at Slamdance. And we have, I think, every single person involved with the movie here talking with us. We have Alexander Franchi, the director, co-writer. We have Joelle Beaujolais, who's also a co-writer, and from the cast, David Roche, Cindy Nicholson, E.R. Ruiz, and Don Shaw. Welcome you all for being here. Thank you for being here.
Thanks.
Thank you.
Okay, Alexander, start us off, introduce our listeners to Happy Face. Tell us about the movie.
Okay, the story. Well, it's an autobiographical story about when I was growing up with my mom. And in this movie, in the story, it's the story of Stan, a 19-year-old teenager who can't handle his mom's illness, her cancer. She's in the hospital. She's going to get face surgery. He feels, he's a bit ashamed of her. And so wanting to be a good son, wanting to prepare for her return home, he deforms his face with bandages and he secretly enters a workshop for facially different or disfigured people just to know what it's like, just to be less shallow, just to cure himself of his superficiality. Kind of a self-therapy, but like, you know, the wrong kind of therapy. But he gets discovered. And when he gets discovered, some patients actually like him. He actually endears himself to some patients because he says, you know, that workshop, that thing about talking nice and being cool and explaining your difference, that doesn't work. People will always see you as different. You got to shove your face in people's bubbles and let them deal with your looks, not you. And some patients embark on it, but Vanessa, the therapist, doesn't want to embark on it. And so we've got this kind of crazy story that starts.
I'm going to immediately throw a comparison out to the great credit of the film, which is One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest.
That did come up when we were writing.
Where you have a character who's put in within a group of people, and he's a complete wild card, and it's combustible, but it's also supportive at the same time. I thought it was wonderful. And I'm thrilled to death that I've got all of you here with us from the cast. And I would love for each one of you to talk about briefly from your own perspective working on the film and working with Alexander on this particular story and being a part of this. David, start with you.
Hey, I got into this because I'm an activist. I wanted to be responsible, but as soon as I got on set, my life changed, and it was fantastic. I credit Alex for bringing out the deeply human in all of us. You know, the love, the hate, the fear, the anger, a little violence, sex. Not for me, unfortunately.
The next film,
that's
Alex.
Going to be in the sequel.
Part two.
You know, David wants to do scenes that the young actor got to do? He says, I want to do a movie where I do all these scenes?
Okay. Hey, that's what it means to be so human, right? Yeah. And that's what came out for us. And that's the title of it. And I think that One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest, that's spot on.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. All right. Cindy.
Well, first time when I got into the therapy session, I realized that this is going to be my changing life. He changed my life totally. I was a person that preferred to be all by myself in my little bubble. I slept in a tent for 6 months, and now since the movie, I don't feel the need that I have to be all by myself. And I suffer, like, I have issues with my mother and society, and now I'm fine. I mean, I don't care what people say about me, and I just hope this movie will change people's minds.
I have to believe it will. Don.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so I got involved because I heard about it through an organization in Canada called About Face. And when I found out that Alex was looking to bring in people that actually had facial differences, I mean, when you grow up with a different face, you don't believe that acting is on your list of possible career choices. And so for me, it was an opportunity to do something that I always wanted to do and never thought that I would be able to do. I mean, I'm a professional motivational speaker, so I'm used to being in front of an audience. And it is a form of performance, but to actually get to be in a movie. And not only that, Alex found out that I could sing on key. And so I think that was one of the reasons he wanted me involved in the project, is so that I could sing. And for me, that was exciting because it's, again, something, I mean, whoever thought, all right, not only do I get to act in a film, but I get to sing as well.
For sure.
That's right.
If I may add to that, you know, it was weird because at first it was hard to cast, but once the word got out, I had to refuse people. Like, you know, I mean, there's only so many pages and so many characters you could put in the screenplay. And with Joelle, you know, we worked on our story for a long time. I don't know, for me as a kid, like the fun, you know, like the fun in everybody. And
I want to get ER in here and talk about working with this guy as a director.
Well, we initially, during the early process, we Skyped each other, and I had an approach to the character, and he wanted me to just kind of be myself in the character. And then during the process of it, working with David, Cindy, and everyone, it was like, it just became organic, you know? We just started feeding each other, and it was really, they had the story, but the shooting just became something that, like, in the moment of, you know, capturing all the character's emotions in that moment, because it was real, kind of. And you can't replace that. You can't do another take on that. You know, a lot of it was like in that moment. And that's all credit to you, because I know, you know, during the filming, what you see is great, but during the process, it's like a whirlwind of different emotions and just, and getting people to come together and, you know. And
me having no shot list.
Yeah.
No storyboards. Having post-traumatic stress from my first feature. Yeah. Being stressed because it's the story of my mom, so I don't want to screw it up. And hope to make money out of my films. So then I become paralyzed. I can't work. I don't do shot lists. So at night I smoke up and I rewrite stuff. And then we do something with Sydney and she starts crying. And then I call Joelle. I go, my God, this scene, it just popped. So we can't have the next scene be lower. We have to change. Yeah, so I keep rewriting. So send that to the give that to the people this morning. They're half awake, all flustered. They don't remember the day you didn't eat. You were action, and she's holding her screenplay in the shot. And I'm like, Cindy, what are you doing? I'm like, did you eat today? No, I'm nervous. I have to sing. Give her a granola bar. Give her a granola bar. So it was kind of like
over the cuckoo's nest.
We were going crazy, and half of my crew was like super pro with Claudine Sauvé, my DP, who's a longtime friend. Collaborator, and the other half, because we were shooting in high season, were newbies that were getting promoted into roles, and so it was kind of like, yeah, it was wonderful. It was like
real life.
I don't know, man. It was Vietnam on the set sometimes, you know.
Wow, I felt like we were just with you on set. My heart's just beating really fast now.
So I lost a few years on my life with this one.
Well,
when for our exit scene, one of my co-stars, Keith, he and I, Alex comes up to us. It's like 2 in the morning, and it's freezing cold, and we have the scene outside. And Alex said, "Do you guys know your lines?" And Keith and I look at each other and are like, what lines? I was like, didn't they give you the new script? No, well, you've got 5 minutes, figure it out.
yeah.
And we did.
Yeah, it was good. It was touching. People, you saw in the first screening, people were like, oh, they were so touched.
Yeah, for Alex and Joelle, I wanted to ask how much the story and the script changed once you finally got it officially cast, and how much input each subject actor had on your character.
A lot, I have to say. So, you know, we worked, Alex and I went to film school together, so we've been working on projects over the years. So this script was 15 years in the making. And
it was a short at first.
It would start as a short. And just over time, you know, we fleshed it out as a feature. And so, you know, like, you do work in a bubble as writers, right? It's just kind of like, you know, sending pages back and forth and things. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, the green light came for the funding, and it's like all of a sudden, okay, now we really got to nail this down. And Alex started casting, and then he would send me tapes and things. And And I just mentioned about Cindy. Her character, Buck, was originally a guy who, you know, and it was his dad. And
we kept the name.
We kept the name, but then when I started...
I love the name, by the way.
As we started hearing more about her story, I was like, why don't we just flip it? This person is Buck. And so then, so we just... you know, modified it and that. And then also Maggie's character. She was like a PhD in anthropology, but our Maggie is a model. She's an actual hand model who's aspiring to be a model. It's like, let's use that. Like, why reinvent the wheel? Why force her into this square hole, peg, whatever? Mm. And ER, I mean, he was originally a Quebec cop. I mean, like a French-Canadian
Yeah,
cop.
Some kind of Italian, bald, kind of like tough-ass cop. And then this is this sweet little guy there.
During
when I was hanging out with Alex during the early process of putting together the film, he brought us together to bond before we actually started shooting, and to like get each other's emotions out and get ready for the character.
The insults,
yeah. And that was pretty interesting because, you know, most of the cast, we don't come from trained, and so it was a good way to like get used to each other. Mm. And during that process also, that's where we kind of joked around about making a song about it. And it happened. It wasn't something we planned, but the whole process of shooting this film was organic. And I was able to get a record a song that was able to be a part of that film.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, again, we've been talking about the film Happy Face, which screens at Slamdance. We've had the director, Alexander Franchi, and his co-writing partner, Joel Boschley, and the cast members, David Roche, Cindy Nicholson, E.R. Ruiz, and Don Shaw. It's been great to have you all here.
Yeah.
Yes.
Thank you.
Thanks, guys.
I want 30 more minutes.
We're wrapping up the Festival Daily Buzz on KCPW, kcpw.org, bff.fm, and kfog.com. This show is made possible with the support of KCPW and Slamdance Film Festival. Our sponsors include Black Rain, hemp-infused products that focus on wellness, relief, and recovery, Studio Movie Grill, opening hearts and minds one story at a time, and Caroline Cremol of Slope Style Realty of KW Park City Keller Williams Real Estate. Additional support is provided by Nasty Women Wines, Pro Bar, Uinta Brewing, Couple Co. Podcast, and Whole Foods Market in Park City. This show is audio produced by Charlene Goto with production help from Angela Rowling and Sophie Gunther. Our executive producer is Lancia Wan.
Tune in tomorrow, which will include interviews with stars of the film Top End Wedding, Miranda Topsell and Gwilym Lee, and Kira Sedgwick and the crew from the episodic Girls Weekend. See you then.